We are just entering the tornado period for Wisconsin and the Midwest and a lot of other places as well. Tornadoes are something that scare, I think, most of us. And at the same time, tornadoes are alluring to some people, and they risk their lives chasing them. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest by phone, Brantley Hargrove, a journalist who's written for Wired, Popular Mechanics, Texas Monthly. He also got inside the effort to reverse engineer super tornadoes using super computers. He's chased violent storms from the Great Plains down to the Texas coast, and we're going to be talking with him about his first book. It is a dandy. It's called The Man Who Caught the Storm, The Life of Tornado Chaser Tim Samaras. And as we talk with him, think about what intrigues you about tornadoes. Have you ever chased a storm? Have you ever seen a tornado? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Brantley Hargrove, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Larry.
Oh, man, what a book. I'm telling you, I really, really enjoyed reading this. You have done a wonderful job of putting us right into Tim Samaras' mind, almost, and the experiences that he went through. You've done a wonderful job of kind of recreating those experiences in your book. It's really a fascinating read. So I thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I tell you what, you're an experienced writer. This is your first book, and you weren't a tornado chaser before you started this book, I don't think. Why did you choose this subject?
Well, I've always been fascinated by tornadoes, you know, ever since I was a little kid, kind of like Tim. I mean, I grew up in Tornado Alley. I'd seen some pretty horrific tornado disasters firsthand at a, you know, fairly impressionable age. I think about 15 or I was 15 or so whenever the Jarrell, Texas tornado happened. You know, EF5, that to this day is kind of legendary among tornado researchers. So I was always sort of interested in it. And whenever I heard about Tim's story and what had happened in El Reno, I mean, I could not write about this guy. I mean, he was, you know, out there trying to unravel some fundamental mysteries of tornadoes and, you know, lost his life in the process.
Yeah, he did indeed. He was an amazing guy. What an interesting guy. Somebody without, who had an kind of self-educated beyond high school.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really interested me about this book. Is, I mean, you know, he wasn't the kind of guy you would expect to pull this thing off. I mean, he was just this dude from Lakewood, Colorado, who happened to be a really good storm chaser and also a really talented inventor and engineer.
It just amazed me that this guy, had he gone to college and majored in engineering, he probably would have been he might have been a straight A student, but then again, I'm not sure if he would have been, because he wasn't. He liked doing, I guess, and tinkering and learning what he, you know, what he was most intrigued with.
Right. Well, he was, you know, I mean, he never liked going to school at all. But, you know, I mean, I think the fact that he came from this kind of odd background, you know, with nothing more than a diploma from Alameda High School in Lakewood, Colorado. I mean, I think he was what the field of atmospheric science was waiting for, because, I mean, you know, these guys with PhDs, these brilliant people, have been going out there with you know, their own tools to, you know, gather data from the heart of a tornado ground level, and nobody had had any luck. And I think they just needed somebody coming at it from a slightly different angle.
Yeah. Well, he started, as you talk about, he was viewing them from a distance and then just kept getting closer and closer.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, you know, whenever he first started storm chasing, I mean, I think Tim was wise enough to know that you can't just light out after a tornado-worn storm not knowing anything about storms and think, you know, A, you're going to see a tornado, and B, that if you do, you're not going to get hurt somehow. So, I mean, he started off, yeah, kind of slowly, took some courses through Skywarn, which is this spotter organization that, works in concert with the National Weather Service to verify tornadoes on the ground. So that's what he was doing, first of all. He was a spotter for the National Weather Service, because his radar can often tell you whether there's rotation within the storm, but it can't necessarily tell you that there's a tornado on the ground. And so that's where this sort of on-the-ground, eyewitness intelligence comes in handy. So he just kind of started out that way. And then it kind of gradually intensified once he met this engineer from Huntsville, Alabama, who had this seismic tornado detection probe that he wanted Tim to go out and test for him. And so that was really how Tim kind of came to this world of using instruments to gather data from tornadoes.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Hans in Winona, Minnesota has got something for us. Let's just go there. Hans, thanks for calling.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me on the air. I captured a tornado live a number of years ago in Minnesota near I-90 and Minnesota Highway 16. And what always baffled me about it was two things. One was that I was videoing on a tripod clouds that were rolling and tumbling and everything else, and the camera was pointed north. I looked south, and out of a flat black cloud was an F0 or an F1 tornado on the ground. And so I spun the camera around and videotaped it, then called 911 to report it, and then got into an argument with the dispatcher that if they don't have a tornado watch, there can't be a tornado on the ground.
That's a testament to the... But to the fact that sometimes the tornadoes stump even the National Weather Service. I mean, there's sometimes we just can't, we can't see them coming. I mean, for the most part, the government's gotten really, really good at predicting these days. But there are days sometimes where they're just, you don't see the usual indicators coming together, and yet something happens.
Well, there were, and people have tried to figure out, spent a lot, many, many, many years trying to figure out a tornado, what it is, how it develops. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was starting as back, as late as the 50s, or as early as the 50s. The National Weather Service, at the time, I think it was the Weather Bureau. They didn't even really bother issuing tornado forecasts. There was a lot of institutional resistance to that because, we simply didn't know about how they form to be able to predict, when and where they might occur. Now, that's changed over the year with the advent of Doppler radar. It's still a forecast challenge. I mean, it's still increasingly difficult to predict these things, but we have gotten a lot better at it. I mean, and we're able to predict them, with surprising accuracy sometimes. I mean, including chasers. I mean, these guys know how to be in the right place at the right time. But, I mean, there's still some mysteries out there in terms of, a particular storm. What's the difference between a storm that produces a tornado and, the one that doesn't? How do we detect the mechanisms in the sky that may yield these legendary violent tornado days, and the ones where you may see a couple of, moderate to strong but fairly short-lived tornadoes. I mean, there are just some mechanisms in the sky that we just haven't been able to figure out how to see yet.
Yeah. And when Tim Samaras started, we didn't have Doppler radar.
Well, we had Doppler radar whenever Tim got going, certainly. But what we didn't have that early was mobile Doppler, and huge advance for the field. Is this mobile Doppler radar? These guys hauling these research grade radars out into the field. Into close proximity, tornadoes. That's enabled us to get more data on increasingly low levels of the storm, but. Generally, with mobile Doppler radar, you still can't get that lowest level of data, that, on the ground where we build our homes and where we live, simply because radar operates on line of sight. And, even if you're a mile out, half a mile out or something like that from the tornado, depends on how much nerves of steel you have, because you've got a $1 million instrument on the back of your truck. it's still can't get that low, and that's where Tim Samaras's on the ground instrument probe came into play. It could actually get into that place where mobile radar and radar can't see.
Let's talk about some more about him and how he became an engineer working with explosives. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, well, after he graduated from high school, I think he was working for a mom-and-pop radio repair shop, because he'd had, ever since he was a kid, this knack for electronics, just for figuring out what was wrong with them, how to use them. When he was about 20 years old, he approached this guy at the Denver Research Institute. It was this applied science outfit at the University of Denver. And they were looking for an instrumentation engineer, basically somebody who could use research-grade electronics to study the kinds of things that the Denver Research Institute would study. And that was namely, among other things, but mostly that seemed like they were working with military explosives. One of his first big projects was this enormous conventional explosives test out on White Sands Missile Range, near where they detonated the first atomic bomb.
And you know what? Hold on to that story, Brantley, for just a minute. We're going to take a look at the news and weather, and then because I want people to hear that whole story. Brantley Hargrove is our guest today. He's the author of a fascinating book. It's titled The Man Who Caught the Storm, and the subtitle is The Life of Legendary Tornado Chaser Tim Samaras. You can join in 800-642-1234, and we'll be back with Brantley right after the news. Talking about tornadoes and tornado chasing with the author of a new book on chaser Tim Samaras, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. With me by phone, Brantley Hargrove, a journalist who has gone inside the effort to reverse engineer super tornadoes using supercomputers. He's chased violent storms from the Great Plains down to the Texas coast. And his first book, it's a dandy. It's called The Man Who Caught the Storm, The Life of Tornado Chaser Tim Samaras. You may have some questions about storm chasing. Maybe you have an experience with a tornado. What are your thoughts on Tim Samaras? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. And send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And Brantley, just as we were breaking for news, you were talking about Tim and his first job. In the first place, why did he get hired in the first place? Because he really didn't have the degrees behind his name.
No, he didn't. He was probably one of the least qualified people, at least on paper, for that job. I mean, yeah, Tim, he only had a high school diploma. And, when he walked into Larry Brown's office, the guy who was running the Denver Research Institute, he was wearing jeans that had holes in the knees and a T-shirt. And he didn't even bring a resume the first time he walked in there. But they got to talking, and Larry saw that, Tim clearly knew his stuff. He was conversant. He seemed intelligent and affable, like a guy who'd be okay to work with. And so Larry was like, bring a resume back. And so Tim did the next day, came with a yellow sheet of paper in which he'd handwritten his experience in a pencil. And Larry was, former military guy, and he went with his gut on Tim. There was something he liked about him. He saw that Tim had real potential, and so he gave him the job. And it was, it was for a guy like Tim Samaras, who liked to tinker and do experiments and stuff like that. I mean, there really wasn't a better job that he could possibly have.
Yeah, and his first big deal was this explosion, and he pulled it off.
He's 20 years old. By this point, I think he's a little older than that. But he's got a Pentagon security clearance, and he gets to ring this site, near the Trinity site at White Sands Missile Range. They've got 4,000 some odd tons of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil rigged to blow. They're basically going to be simulating a nuclear explosion just without the fallout. And Tim has the site ringed with ultra-high-speed cameras that he's got to trigger at exactly the right moment to catch millisecond by millisecond the progress of this explosion so they can understand how these really huge events and these shock waves behave, how they crater, you know, their effects on other structures. And so, you know, it was a pretty interesting experience for Tim. I mean, he was in a bunker with Larry Brown, probably closer to the explosion than anybody else. And I think it was a big day for him, and I think it was one of many days where he would learn how to use research-grade electronics to capture exceptionally violent events.
Yeah, it was probably good training for him in a lot of ways for what he did with tornadoes. To be perfectly honest. Well, he winds up using. Well, he got interested in tornadoes, I think, in part from a television show.
Right. Well, you know, first it was the Wizard of Oz when he was a little boy, and then when, you know, after he started having kids and he had a wife and a family, he saw this NOVA documentary about these scientists at the National Severe Storms Laboratory and at Oklahoma University, who built this instrument that they were going to try to deploy into the core of a violent tornado. Tim saw these guys, you know, on TV, you know, going after these storms, going and chasing these storms, which is, you know, at that point, I don't think it was something he'd really ever considered before, that you could actually just get in a car and go hunt a tornado down and see it. And so that was really what got him storm chasing. And later it would kind of serve as inspiration, along with this this guy he worked with from Alabama and his tornado seismic detection probe. You know, Tim thought, hey, maybe I could do what these guys do. Maybe I could build my own instrument and take it out there and gather data that had never been obtained before from tornadoes.
Yeah, just an amazing story. And the how he was able to pull together, I'm forgetting now what he called those bullet-like.
Yeah, the Hardened In Situ Tornado Pressure Recorder, or HITPR for short, was this instrument he built. He saw a call for proposals from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And so he was like, yeah, I'm the guy who can do this. I've got all of the requisite skills to build something that can survive in a very violent environment, and then emerge on the side with you know, precise, really good data. And so that's what he did. He built the Hardened In Situ Tornado Pressure Recorder, and he set out. You know, really started at the beginning of 2000. You know, the beginning of tornado season in the year 2000, in 2001, to go try to gather data.
And it's not. It wasn't an easy thing to do, was it?
No, it was incredibly difficult. I think Tim got a taste for what all these other scientists who've been trying to do the same thing. You know, I mean, he felt their frustration. I mean, you know, 2001, not a lot to show for his efforts. 2002, he gets really close. I mean, he deploys on this tornado in Pratt, Kansas, so close that if he had been standing where his probe was, he probably could have chunked a rock into that tornado and hit it. So, I mean, you know, it's not that these are completely without value. I mean, as he's deploying on these tornadoes and missing, he's learning how close he really needs to be in order to pull this thing off. I mean, he's got to be really, really close, because tornadoes, I mean, they may kind of travel in a generally straight line, but it's not completely straight. They're zigs and zags, and if you're not very close, odds are you may miss the tornado. So it isn't until 2003 that Tim finally sees success. I mean, that's, you know, nearly three seasons of chasing and not getting a whole lot. So I mean, it was incredibly frustrating. But 2003 was a signal day in the history of atmospheric science.
Yeah, it sure was. Can you describe that? You do such a nice job of describing it in the book, but give our listeners a kind of a flavor of what went on that day.
Well, yeah, that day he'd been chasing this tornado near Woonsocket, South Dakota, and he was just having such a hard time with his tornado. It was staying into the fields, and Tim can't deploy in the field. He's got to deploy on a road. And so by the time it finally comes to a road, The tornado starts roping out, which means it's starting to dissipate. And so he's, you know, pretty frustrated. And then he sees, you know, back to the east, there's this other storm that looks pretty strong. So he takes off after it. And as he approaches, he sees that, you know, my God, this is an enormous Plains Titan of a tornado. I mean, the kind of tornado he's really never seen before. The strongest and likely the largest tornado he's ever personally encountered. And so as he's coming up on the highway, you know, towards this beast, you know, he realizes he can't deploy on this highway. It's too close. It's too dangerous. So he decides to navigate this grid of dirt roads to the north. And the idea is he's going to take this dirt road to the north and then cut over on the next east road ahead of this tornado, drop his probe at the next intersection, and flee with the wind at his heels. This is incredibly dangerous because the roads are muddy, and the tornado is at times rain-wrapped. There are times when he and his partner, that's actually his brother-in-law, Pat Porter, can't really see the tornado. So, I mean, it gets incredibly dangerous. But he gets to this intersection ahead of the tornado, drops his probe, and then flees. And the probe is run over by the core of this really violent F4 tornado. And on that day, he gets the first data of its kind. He gets data, pressure, humidity, temperature from the core of a violent tornado. I mean, this was something that meteorology didn't have until then.
And why was it so important to get that information? Why did they do it?
Yeah, well, because it's a blank space in the equation. If we're going to understand tornadoes, how they develop, how they intensify, how they die, we need data from all elevations of the tornado. We need it from high up, and we need it from at the ground too, because that's where we live, that's where we build our homes, and that's where we die. And so, if we're going to understand these things, if we're going to use numerical models to understand vortex behavior, you've got to have that kind of data. You know, if engineers are going to understand exactly what sorts of wind speeds, precise wind speeds, not just estimates based on a destroyed house, but precise, calibrated wind speeds, off of which to build more tornado-resistant homes, we need that kind of data. And so Tim was the first ever to get that kind of data. And, it didn't solve the puzzle, but it certainly gave us a really big piece of it.
And he was, and he became very well known because of that. I think National Geographic with him on that time?
Oh, they were, yeah. They had a photographer embedded with him who was, I mean, he barely made it out too. I've actually seen video where Pat Porter is shooting out from, you know, the back window of Tim's minivan. And there's, you know, the vehicle that the Nat Geo photographer is in. There's a tornado right on their heels. I mean, it's really incredible. But yeah, he was the Nat Geo photographer was there, and Tim ended up on the cover of National Geographic magazine, as well as, you know, he was on Oprah, he was on CNN. I mean, he became quite a figure in the field of atmospheric science. I mean, you know, people have been trying for decades to get this kind of data. And then Tim pulled it off, and I think everybody was pretty shocked.
Yeah, I think you're right. He was an independent cuss in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was. You know, Tim. I think Tim had an independent streak. I think he was confident, and I think he also just had some experiences early on where he had signed on to big research projects where there's a pretty inflexible chain of command, and it's being guided by, you know, these really brilliant PhDs. And so, you know, in those situations, you know, he didn't have really a whole lot of luck at all deploying his probe. And so I think that sort of cemented in his mind that if he's going to do the impossible, he needs to be independent. He needs to be out there heeding his own instincts beneath the storm. And so I think that was, a lesson that both guided and dogged him, because, yeah, I think there was certainly something to be said for Tim's instinct as a chaser. I mean, he pulled it off. But I think there's also something to be said for pairing up with, you know, PhD science, people who can actually make sense of his data. And, I mean, in later years, he did do that. He formed TwistX with two really brilliant PhDs, Bruce Lee and Kathy Finley, both from Minnesota originally. It was definitely sort of a, it had its pluses and minuses throughout his years, this sort of independent streak.
And I think, though, that you mention or talk about in the book the fact that he actually kind of needed those people in a way, because he didn't have the degrees behind his name. So if he was going to apply for money, he needed to have those letters, people with those letters behind their name, in order for him to be funded.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. Tim was pretty unusual in the world of atmospheric science because of the source of his funding. I mean, it was private by and large. From places like National Geographic and the Discovery Channel, whereas most of your usual atmospheric field science outfits are going to be funded by, say, the National Science Foundation or university. It definitely made his life a little more difficult in that funding each year was sort of an open question. You never really knew whether it would come through, and often when it did come through, it would be pretty late. They'd be rushing to, put this money to work, fixing their gear, calibrating their sensors. So it was always a struggle, this independent funding that you'd have to cobble together year after year.
And he, for the most part, I'm trying to remember exactly, I mean, he would spend his, use all of his vacation, essentially, for chasing storms.
Yeah, and he was, whenever he got signed up with Discovery Channel, I think that helped a lot.
Yeah.
Just in terms of funding. But, definitely in some of the earlier years, and then in some of his very, very later years, he would be funding himself to a large degree. Nat Geo would cover some of it, but Tim would have to take a leave of absence sometimes. Use up all his vacation days to stay out there on the road. So he's always kind of on a shoestring, really, until the Discovery Channel came along, and that allowed, it had its drawbacks, but it also allowed him to fully fund his research organization and to stay out on the road as long as he needed to.
And he had an interesting, he had a really, I think I would call it a great relationship with his wife and family, that he could actually go out and do this and in the keep his marriage.
Right. Yeah. It was kind of something that I think was probably the envy of a lot of storm chasers. Kathy was really supportive and understanding. I think she had her concerns from time to time, but I think she also was like, Tim is the expert, and no storm chasers have ever been killed while chasing tornadoes. So, if you're not Monday morning quarterbacking, it doesn't actually look like there's a whole lot to worry about. Once Paul got of age, his son got a little older, he started going out on the road with Tim. I think they really formed this unique bond out on the road. I think they came together in ways that were unique for a father and his teenage son. And I think it was a great experience for Paul, because I think in a lot of ways he idolized him. I mean, Tim was this huge figure in the world of storm chasing and of atmospheric science as well. And so Paul got to see his father in action and got to share in this world with him.
Tim and Paul, his son Paul, and then their chase partner Carl Jung, or Young, was it pronounced Young or Jung?
Young.
Mm-hmm. Young. They came up against a tornado, a record-breaking one, near Oklahoma City. Talk about what happened there.
Yeah, that was a really crazy day. All the atmospheric indicators were, really off the scale. Just the level of instability in the atmosphere that day was almost unheard of. And, Tim, Paul, and Carl, they simply could not resist chasing this tornado. It was clear it was going to be an interesting day. And so they were on this tornado from the very beginning, and they were pursuing it with an eye towards deploying one of Tim's instrument probes. They were also in a vehicle that they would not normally be deploying in. They were in a Chevy Cobalt, you know, this four-cylinder sedan. Normally they'd be chasing in a 4x4 GMC diesel. I mean, this really, really tough, really powerful truck. But they, you know, they'd had other projects that year. They were out there trying to film and study lightning and other electromagnetic phenomena. So they'd brought this little vehicle along with them for side chases, and they had it loaded down with not only their bodies but three steel probes. And so, you know, they're having a really hard time catching up with this tornado as it begins to evolve. It's, you know, it's going to the south, the southeast, the east, and eventually the northeast, and they're really having a difficult time keeping up to it and also keeping it within range. So, you know, at some points they have to dive south after it, and actually, you know, it turns on them, and they end up in the debris core at one point, actually getting hit by debris. So they head north to trying to get out of this thing. And, you know, they continue to parallel this tornado as they had often done, you know, many times before. You know, keep north of the tornado and deploy your probe in front of it. And this tornado, you know, it came to the north towards them as they would have expected. But what they didn't expect was for the tornado to be approaching at nearly, you know, highway speeds, to be rain-wrapped so that they couldn't see it, and to grow exponentially and explosively to 2.6 miles in width. It did all these things at the same time. It's very unusual. And it overcame them. They were caught in the parent tornado's flow, and they were overtaken by one of its subvortices, this tornado within the larger tornadoes, where the most intense wind speeds in the tornado were found. And it killed them. It tossed their vehicle a great distance.
Yeah, and tore the vehicle apart in the process. And obviously a very, very sad day for a lot of people, not only his family, but so many other people connected with this kind of work and this kind of research. Just thinking about, and you talk about this, what his contribution was or the impact that he had.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, the impact he had on chasers, you know, I think a lot of the chasers who knew him and were there, I think this has changed their behavior. You know, I think that they're going to be more careful from here on out.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are other chasers who I don't know that they've learned the lessons. you know, I saw a chaser's video recently where he drove with his girlfriend or his wife, I'm not sure, right into a strong tornado. I can't even fathom what the thought process was there, and they're lucky to be alive.
So
there are clearly some people who still like to play in dangerous places. But, you know, I think he inspired the research community as well. I mean, you know, in addition to this first-of-its-kind data that he gathered, he also showed that the field of atmospheric science, that this was actually possible, that you could get data from the core of a violent tornado at ground level. I think this was, you know, this was something that a lot of researchers weren't sure was possible. And so, you know, now I think people have been inspired by him. You know, you've got people like Josh Werman over there at the Center for Severe Weather Research, who's to this day, he and his crew are trying to deploy probes into the core of violent tornadoes.
Bradley, you have written a fascinating book. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah, Bradley Hargrove, our guest. His book, The Man Who Caught the Storm, The Life of Legendary Tornado Chaser Tim Samaras. Fascinating, fascinating book. And I thank him very much for being with us today, and I thank you very much for joining us. Tomorrow, Vijay Pandian joins us for Garden Talk. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.